we've got so good at measuring everything, and there's been it's been very subtle and imperceptible, and with very good motives, I hasten to add, really good motives, around saying we want to keep these guys healthy, we want to avoid injury, we therefore measure everything, and we're going to pay attention to the load that we're putting these guys in so that they don't break, because these are valuable resources potentially, and our job as practitioners is to keep these guys fit and healthy. And so the minute we shift away from a performance first mindset to a protective mindset, I think that that comes in and subtly changes all of the decisions that we make.
Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast, the podcast that dives into the philosophies, ideas, and practices of some of the best practitioners in high performance sport. So today we have the head of physiotherapy and rehabilitation at Irish Rugby, Phil Glasgow, coming on the podcast. So in this episode, and it's been an episode that's been a long time coming, I actually saw Phil speak at an Ulster Rugby conference just before COVID hit, and I could listen to Phil all day, and you'll know exactly what I mean when you dive into this episode. So we have a little chat around what we can learn as practitioners who are not in a centralized system, for those that have developed and are in a centralized system. Then we have a little chat around player monitoring, daily player monitoring, and how different tests and different screens can actually help us or hinder us in the process of deciding whether an intervention is needed prior to training or within training. So a really impressive, super, super impressive episode coming up with Phil, which I'm sure you'll love. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Hawken Dynamics. Hawken Dynamics is the world's first wireless force plate testing system. The Hawken Dynamics system is built for coaches to test in the real world, not just in the lab. Capture reliable data on all your athletes in a matter of minutes and monitor their progress in the cloud from anywhere in the world. The Hawken Dynamics force plates are wireless, portable, and trusted by teams at every level of sport. Integrating force plates into your athlete monitoring program has never been easier or more affordable. If you want to see the Hawken Dynamics force plate system in action, head over to their website, hawkendynamics.com, to schedule a demo or follow them on Twitter at Hawken Dynamics. And this episode is also sponsored by Kitman Labs. Kitman Labs is sport's first technology company to offer a complete solution that includes innovative analytics and an advanced athlete management platform that is supported by a team of sports, technology, and data science experts with over 200 years experience. Kitman Labs is leading the evolution of sports performance, partnering with over 150 elite teams across the NFL, NHL, MLB, AFL, EPL, and Championship Rugby. Through advanced statistical analysis, rigorous scientific research, and unparalleled industry experience, they've architected the world's only analytics platform that helps sports teams to truly harness their data and uncover the influences behind performance optimization and injury risk. To find out more about Kitman Labs, visit kitmanlabs.com or follow them on social media at Kitman Labs. And this episode is also sponsored by Black Box Fitness. Black Box Fitness are leaders in performance training equipment and facility design. Black Box are specialists in designing and building performance facilities for sports teams and strength and conditioning coaches. Black Box manufacture and distribute a full range of strength training equipment from their headquarters in Belfast right across Europe. If you want to learn more about Black Box, check out their website blackboxfitness.com or follow them on social media at Black Box Fitness. So without further ado, over to the episode with Phil. Phil Glasgow, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, Rob, really, really good to have you. It's super. I've always enjoyed listening to these for many years and great to join you. Yeah, super.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for fitting me in your busy schedule. Anyone doesn't know who you are, Phil, would you mind just giving us a bit of a intro to you, background, what you're currently doing? I know you've got quite a few things going on, so it'd be nice to hear about that as well.
Yeah, where do you start with those? I suppose physio by trade initially. quite some time ago now, graduated as that, and currently working sort of a bit of a mix of things, but primary role, if you like, as head of physio and rehab for Irish Rugby. And I also do all the consultancy work. I'm a visiting professor at Ulster Uni, involved with sort of postgraduate stuff there, and some research and teaching and master's programs. And then I also work as an executive coach, working across business and with different people, helping in development. And I guess that's sort of sits at the heart of it. It's about helping people perform, helping people develop and grow, whether that's in their profession, whether it's, you know, as athletes, and you know, I guess then as well personally, you know. So that's my role up and down over the years. I've worked in high performance sport for quite some time, and was in the UK Sports Institute Network for 14-15 years. Worked through the Olympic cycles of Beijing, London, and Rio. Was fortunate enough to be chief physio for Team GB back in 2016 in Rio, and then took a bit of a shift after that, after a period of time for a fresh and a new challenge.
Nice.
Yeah.
Executive coach.
Mm.
You're the third, well, you're being the executive coach. I've never had someone on the podcast who is the executive coach. I've had two people on, Bryce Kavanagh and Jeremy Bettle recently, who've got coaches. And I'm always interested because it's becoming more and more popular. Because obviously people are seeing the huge value in it from a personal and a career perspective. Can you tell us a little bit more about the kind of people that you work with, what you do? Just, I'd love to know more.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think executive coaching has grown massively over the last few years. And I guess over the last number of years, I've been doing some executive coaching for probably 6-7 years more. Always doing, you know, done mentoring and things like that, and it fitted well, I think, with background, but coaching is certainly different. And I guess the beauty of coaching, and we're really familiar in sport with coaching in terms of sports coaching, and some of the principles are very similar, but I think the underlying principles that sit, which I think are really powerful within coaching, are you start off with the assumption that the person you're coaching has all of the skills and attributes to come to the solutions that they need to find. And your job then as a coach is to have disruptive conversations, to ask good questions, to go on a guided sort of joint exploration, if you like, of whatever those themes might be. That might even be really a time really figuring out what the issue really is. And what's quite remarkable, and I think in life generally, just having time set aside, and I obviously work with a coach personally as well, and I'm a coach, but what's really powerful is the ability to actually sit for a duration of time, be that an hour, a couple of hours, and to speak freely, openly, candidly, but also then to be listened to really well. And it's also an opportunity that I often hear, the thing I hear most common as a coach is someone saying, this is the first time I've actually said this out loud. So we think things a lot, but there's something in the speaking of it and the unpacking of it that for whatever reason, some people might be able to inform me of the science underpinning it, but for whatever reason, I think unlocks things for us. It helps us understand things a little bit better by speaking through things and talking them through, and then by saying it out loud. And people saying, as I'm saying this, it's now starting to fall into place. I don't realize why I've never seen this before. And so those are sort of daily occurrences in the coaching space, I would suggest. So coaching is certainly not about telling people what to do, but helping people to discover and come to conclusions and to ask challenging questions and challenge assumptions perhaps at times as well.
So the majority of the people that you work with as the coach yourself, performance practitioners, are they business people? Who are they?
Yeah, a nice mix of those, actually. I guess, you know, I use coaching skills and coaching practice every day. So if I'm working in Irish rugby, you know, the people that I'll lead there, you know, I'll have coaching sessions and use coaching skills with them. But in terms of people who are coaches, pure coaches, so some performance practitioners from various backgrounds, and be they, like some of them are coaches, some are strength and conditioning coaches, some are performance directors, you know, in that space. But probably the majority of people I work with work from the business world. I do a lot of work with guys in the tech sector, which is fascinating, and a nice range of sort of, you know, young, bright, Really good young people coming through, and then some really seasoned senior directors, C-suite level people. And it's nice seeing that journey and the contrast that you see there and the lessons that they learned, you know. So I find it hugely helpful for me personally. I think I bring those lessons into the day-to-day practice with, you know, and across every part of life as well. So so a real mix, and I think there's real lessons that you can apply from the sporting world, certainly to the business world, but you can certainly take some out of that business world back into the sporting world.
Mm. Interesting. I think it's a fascinating area, especially on the when business people are tapping into you and seeing what, like you say, what can transfer from sport into the business, and obviously vice versa from the business to the sport world. Really interesting.
Yeah, and I think we may chat more about it, but do you know that thing about instantaneous, sort of contemporaneous feedback in the moment and being able to do it? You know, which is what good practitioners do, isn't it, in every day when working with athletes. That's the thing that I think business can really take from the sporting world that doesn't always happen, you know, and in the moment constantly looking to get better. And is this a teachable moment? Can we step into it? Can we get something from it? Those are things we're used to working in sport all the time. That's our bread and butter. So I think that's a real standout.
Interesting. Right. Let's dive into the pre-arranged kind of stuff, even though that is super, super interesting from my perspective. So building a centralized system. So some people might not know about the system in Ireland and the four provinces and whatnot. Would you be able to just give us a bit of an overview of how that runs from a performance perspective?
Of course. So Irish rugby, I think it's not entirely unique, but it was initially when it was sort of professionalism in rugby was set up, there was a conscious decision to have a centralized approach. So we have the Irish Rugby Football Union, RFU, and then we organise that around four provinces from Ireland, which are Ulster, Munster, Connacht and Leinster. And in those four provinces sit our professional players, there are four professional teams. And in that we have some guys who are centrally contracted, and we sort of set the tone to create a centralized system. But there's also a local autonomy in terms of, you know, some of their recruitment and other things that they might do. What we see in that in each of those provinces are our heads of discipline. So be that our head physio, or head of athletic performance, or nutrition, our head coaches. All of those people are recruited centrally by the RFU. And so that maintains a bit of consistency. So we talk about then you've got your four provinces and then your national team. And the goal of the system is essentially for national success, and that idea of the better the provinces are, the better the national team will be. And, you know, often, and my colleague Nick Winkleman often uses the phrase about the power of five. We've got the four provinces plus the union. And by putting those five things together, we can get five times the information, and hopefully grow and develop our understanding five times faster. So there's a real benefit in that. So you always walk the fine line with those things around creating consistency, a collaborative approach, but not being sort of dictating so much what happens in that local context, because we remember that these are four distinct provincial sides that are competing in competitions, at times competing against each other. And so the system is about building the whole system well, while at the same time having some core centralized things that we all share.
I'd love to get into the nitty-gritty of what those who are not in a centralized program can learn from your successes and mistakes along the way from a centralized program. But Phil, what are the biggest challenges with a centralized program? Because it's obviously, like you said right at the end there, it's extremely complex because you're putting some structure in place with clubs and organizations that are competing against each other.
Yeah, and I think historically it's no surprise, and people would expect that, you know, whenever you're competing against each other, that in a time there'd be a reticence for sharing, and that people are seen as your competitor. And the other thing that I became really aware and I moved into that system was when you're in a province or in any team, you probably only ever see that team and you only ever see that province. And so people aren't really aware of what's happening in the other provinces. The benefit of my role set as a centralized role is that I move across the system and I see all of the teams, all of the time. And then you realize that my perspective is quite unique compared to the guys working on the ground there. And I guess what you realize really early on, and I think back to when I worked even within the, you know, the Olympic sports system and the opportunity I've had to travel into various different sports and teams, is that, and I mean this in the best possible way, everybody thinks their location, what they do, is unique and special. But there's actually way more similarities between everybody. You know, everybody's doing broadly the same thing. We're facing the same challenges every day. We're all trying to get the best out of our players or our athletes. We're all trying to build robustness. We're all trying to develop good practitioners. So we're all trying to do the same thing. And we're broadly looking at the same sources, reading the same papers, listening to the same podcasts, have the same influences. And so actually we realize that there's way more similarity here than we think. And so the difference then isn't about the access to information. The difference is about how you take that and apply it in practice, isn't it? And so I guess what we started off with, and one of my goals whenever I come in, is I've been working in the RFU now for about 4.5 years. And my initial goal was, how do I establish some trust between these guys and show that by sharing these things, you're not giving away trade secrets. You're not, you know, going to give away things that are going to really benefit the other person, and you're not going to get anything from it. And recognize that actually it's mutually beneficial. So that was the real challenge, is how do you establish some trust? How can you demonstrate that there's benefit and value for the teams in being able to share stuff? And actually, I think that's what we've really managed to achieve over the last period of time. I think at a practitioner level, the guys now see themselves as peers, as there's opportunity for real support there. And that's where they get real insights. Now, they're not giving away the calls and the tactics for the game at the weekend. And when they're playing against each other, there's the friendly bit of banter that goes with it. But actually, you realize that it's about being good, and that you know, one of the sayings I always like is, you know, you can't give or you can't get anything or take anything with a closed hand, you know. So it's like, with, if you go with an open hand, you've got to give and receive, and in that you realize that actually everybody gets better.
Mm-hmm. I know a few years ago you went through a player tracking tender, so you all pulled all the provinces into one streamlined system, and I'm guessing that's happened on, especially when it comes to technology, on multiple areas. Is there anything that, not talking about tactics and technical stuff, but is there anything that is left to the provinces and, okay, that's your thing, we won't try to kind of bring this in-house and make it a centralized problem that's for you to go away and solve and do on your own? Is there any examples like that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and one of the sort of mantras that we would often talk about, and you know, I share this with Nick as well, is that, you know, there's autonomy on how, but continuity in what, and then collaboration on why, in terms of our practice. And so the actual day-to-day stuff of, you know, how you do it, there's real autonomy at that level. Like, we're nobody sitting centrally and saying, this is how you've got to plan your week. But what we are saying is that we've collaborated and we've said what's really important to say. For example, you know, some eccentric load through hamstrings or very high speed running meters. And so we've all agreed that that's important. Now, how you get those is up to you. You know, at what point in the week, for example. And so that would be one example of real local autonomy. Other things, however, what you see is where where specific issues arise. So we identify a particular area that they want to focus on around their game plan, for example, or it might be around using specific technology in a specific space. If people have an opportunity for some of that development of stuff, there's certainly real openness to that. But what we try to do then is, and I know you had Nicole Van Dijk recently as well, who works with us and is our sort of medical research lead and leads some of the sort of performance projects. What we have then centrally is that, you know, people may approach Nicole or myself or Nick or some of the guys sitting centrally and say, you know, here's a question that we have that might be related to performance. Now, because we've got a broad view of things, we can say, well, we know if someone else is thinking the same thing or asking the questions, but if they're not, then our job is how to support them to start finding those solutions or those insights. If there are other people asking the same questions, then our job is to connect them, to facilitate, to ensure that the project is as good as it possibly can be. And so what often happens is we'll start off with little projects across the system, and if we feel like it's growing and it's beneficial to the whole system, then we'll look at a way in which we can roll that out across the system. But there's certainly lots of other, you know, projects that are happening that are just confined to the specific provinces.
Mm-hmm. So there won't be many, I guess there won't be many people out there who are listening who are involved in a centralized program. But is there any key learnings from your experience in the centralized program that people can take into their individual organizations? I suppose from a global sense, if you make it smaller and shrink it down, that is very similar to an isolated organization environment. So is there anything there that you can share with us?
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple of things in that. And so over the last couple of years, actually sort of during the initial COVID lockdown, what we did, I led a strategy piece around all of the support structures. And we then produced what our performance support program around and how that looks. And we went through a process where we involved people from all of the different ologies, if you like, at different levels, so some really experienced, some less experienced, and coaching and operations, so people from across the whole system. And we looked at sort of our five pillars, which was about body, mind, people, place, and then research and innovation. And we really got our teeth into what are some of the physical bits, what are some of the psychological, mental components of what was the environmental, the place part of it, the people, what type of people, how can we build, develop and retain our talent, but you know, what kind of people thrive in this environment, and then how we build a research and innovation strategy that supports all of that. And in that, what we did was we got people from different places in the same room having lots of conversations, really listening and allowing the principles to emerge, if you like. And what came out of that, I think, were three big pillars that we build our entire performance support program around. And the first, and they are connect, deliver, and excel. And the first thing was, you know, how do we connect really well? How do we connect with each other, with our goals? How do we connect with our environment? How do we connect with our practitioners? But how do we connect with our players? How do we build an environment that's characterized by trust and mutual support? So I think these things, now there's added challenges when you're trying to do that at a system-wide level, but that's absolutely the starting point, I think, for really good practice. So how do we connect really well across discipline, transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, intradisciplinary, with our players, with our goals, with our environment, with our stakeholders? And then the deliver part, you know, so what does good delivery look like? First and foremost, it's collaborative and it's performance focused. It's not, if you like, the stuff that is my little pet project. Do you know, mm-hmm. And often that's the thing that we do, is think because I like it. It's my area of interest. So once we've connected well, then it enables us to deliver stuff really well. And you know, then how do we continue to get better? How do we learn from that? How do we excel? How do we reflect? How do we adapt? How do we review? How do we constantly improve? How do we get into good knowledge transfer? And so that is an ongoing iterative cycle. Are we, you know, is how we review what we're doing? How well are we connecting our reviews now? How well have I connected? What's my delivery been like? Am I getting better? And the things that underpin that are exactly the same at a local level as they are at a global level. And I think the big takeaways for me is creating opportunities to get in the same room and really connect, to really identify what the key goals are, to understand those things really well, to get really good discussion and allow that to drive the activity and the program, rather than often it gets driven the other direction. And I think it becomes even more important when you're trying to bring people together across a system. But I think it's absolutely critical as well if you're working in a sort of a single system or single team.
On the connect, yeah, 100%. On the connect pillar, is there anything from a day-to-day perspective that people could take away from your learnings and go, okay, we don't have this in place, this is a starting point, I don't know, a daily meeting amongst key practitioners, whatever that might be? Is there any examples that you could give from a super basic day-to-day level?
It's a bit like, let's not, we can often confuse conversations with connection. They're quite different things, aren't they? And anybody in any working relationship or personal relationship, I guess, inhabiting the same space and speaking to each other doesn't mean that you're feeling well connected to them. And so we start ourselves with some questions, going to ask, who do I need to connect with today and why? How am I going to do that? Is there opportunity? And these are the really key things. And hopefully this points to your question, Rob, if keep me on track if I'm going off here. But opportunities for the informal, unstructured connection. If all our connection is just we're having a meeting and we're going to talk about ABC and it's very structured, then the opportunity for the generative, the occasional, let's occasion these opportunities to connect. So if you're a practitioner, are you on the side of the pitch getting an opportunity to have that chat with the coach? Are you talking? Some of the best conversations I've had with our head coach has been, you know, at the side of a pitch, or actually when I've been in the gym training myself and he's been training, you know, and you have those opportunities for a conversation or just the corridor conversation. So making sure that you create a system that enables those points of collision, if you like, that are informal. But then also being really intentional about our structured, more formal in the sense of their scheduled interactions. So being really intentional to make sure that we're having those regularly, and there's different types of those. So there's the short huddles every morning to make sure we're all on the same page, what's going on. We're having regular, multiple meetings each day where we're connecting to make sure everything's in place. Regular, I would suggest, weekly and more than once a week meetings, we're sitting down and saying, what's happening? How are we tracking? What, you know, are we doing what we said we were going to do? You know, at the start of the week, what's going to happen at the end of the week? Did we do what we said we were going to do? And so making sure that those things are embedded into the normal cadence of a day and a week, I think is really critically important. And the first thing that tends to slip when you get under pressure, I think, are those things. People, when they're under pressure, the first thing they do is they focus on the job that's right in front of them, and they do their thing really well. But when you lose connection, then you lose that multiplier effect, I think. And so really paying attention to how often are we really connecting informally and formally, the occasional ones that just happen by serendipity and the ones that are in the diary that must happen. So every morning, certainly say for the national team, every morning in camp, 5 minutes, let's review and we'll talk about monitoring, but let's review what's happening, who's the standouts in the monitoring, whose responsibility is it to chase it up? Have you done it? Now what's happening? Sitting down every night at the end of the day, what were our takeaways from today? What do we need to bring into tomorrow? Those things that are locked in as well as all of the other stuff. Sorry, there's a lot there.
No, that's great. That'd have been a perfect segue into the daily monitoring system that we've got planned. But I just want to ask you one final thing on this, and it's the influence that COVID's had on this connection piece, because of, you know, everyone been on Zoom, everyone been remote, and then going, oh, this is available, we can make this work, when actually what you're saying is that the beauty and the value of actually being in front of a real human being is obviously so impactful. So how's COVID impacted what that looks like?
Really important point, and it's certainly something I'm seeing across the board. And I think that probably it was one of the things that drove why that became the big number one point right now. Is like our number one priority is how do we connect really well in the right way. Because whilst I think COVID and MS Teams, Zooms, and whatever platform you use has been really great in generating connection at one level, it's not the same, and it's not a surrogate for sitting in a room, being there, absorbing what's happening in the environment. And I think then in terms of that reconnect, and so I see one of the things that we looked at, you know, post COVID, as we was, if you like, Project Reconnect. How do we really reconnect well? And how can we make sure that the opportunities that we have, they're not feeling forced or contrived, but they're intentional and worthwhile? And so that's why stopping and saying, who do I need to connect with and why, and what way will I connect with people? What's the right way? Is it a phone call? Because sometimes phone calls actually can be better. Everything doesn't have to be in Teams. Is it Teams? Is it in person? Is it a coffee? Is it a walk? Do you know, those sorts of looking at our opportunities. And I think the variety of that and being really intentional about it is key, because in many ways, COVID made us more connected than ever to a wider global network, remote network, but perhaps made us slightly less connected to our immediate network because we had to keep distance. And so it's about how do you reconnect at that level.
I'm just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Phil. So in part two, we've got chat around daily player monitoring. our daily player screening, and how we can make decisions effectively off the back of those. So really interesting part two coming up. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Samson Equipment. Samson Equipment has been manufacturing elite strength equipment since 1976. Based in New Mexico, Samson provides professional weight room solutions for those looking to lead the way in advancing our strength and conditioning profession. Being a direct manufacturer, the team at Samson brings fully customization capabilities in not only branding, but in custom equipment needed to execute your programming. The Samson team brings many years of experience not only in coaching, but in manufacturing high quality strength equipment. So there is no vision too great. If you can dream it, they can build it. Find them on social media at Samson_EQ. And for more information, visit their website, samsonequipment.com, or email andy@samsonequipment.com. Also sponsoring this episode is Play. Play is the leader in high-performance athletic flooring and strength equipment globally. So with offices in the US, Australia and the UK, Play provides an end-to-end experience by collaborating with organisations through their own proprietary formula to create world-class environments for coaches and athletes. Play's Achieve 18mm rubber and Attack Turf have been at the cornerstone of elite training facilities for now over a decade, with the addition of the new Icon X rack range. Play are once again set to elevate the industry. On the 23rd of April 2022, Play will be hosting their first UK lab of the year in collaboration with Loughborough University. Play will be joined by some exceptional speakers from elite sport, industry and academia with a huge breadth of knowledge and experience. Listeners and supporters of Pace Performance Podcast are able to obtain an exclusive 20% discount using the code SPORTSMITH20 when registering at playacademy.com/play-labs-Loughborough. And now back to the episode with Phil. Right, rewind 2 minutes and the perfect segue that you set up for us with the daily monitoring system. Mm. So we'll use this connection piece that seems to be a thread, and hopefully we'll thread for the next 45 minutes or 35 minutes or so. What does that daily monitoring system look like for you? And what happens in that daily monitoring system get communicated into these connection pieces that we've spoken about to actually inform training, inform practice?
Yeah, monitoring is one of those things, isn't it, that we've been doing for a very long time, and we monitor everything. And so there's obviously the sense of the passive monitoring in that, you know, we put devices on people or we track and we get data, and the person is, you know, be that our GPS or in the gym or whatever we're doing, we're monitoring workload in that sense. But then, if you like, the daily monitoring piece where we have our players responding across the board in terms of, you know, quality of sleep, soreness, appetite, you know, the general wellness measures that they will put in, and then other measures such as, you know, their sit and reach, groin squeeze, knee to wall, and looking at those measures as well. That those things every day in conjunction with, you know, where they've been in terms of their training load, the natural rhythm that we will have is that, you know, players will submit those on a system. We will then look at is there a shift in those scores, and we'll usually look at are they sitting outside one standard deviation from the norm. And so I think the key thing around monitoring, as you know, is that it must be done over time, and you must have good longitudinal data. Like, a single measure is really pointless. But if we see some people vary a lot, or up and down, some people they're super steady, and so I think that's where there's almost, you know, when we start looking at standard deviations, that people are outside of that, and really understanding the context, then we've got to do something about it. So that's the type of stuff that, if you like, we're monitoring regularly. So what do we do with it? Well, I think then that's collated. We've one person usually within each of the team whose job it is, you know, to make sure monitoring's pooled together and shared across the performance support team. The performance support team then will look at that and have a huddle for, you know, 10 minutes in the morning to say, okay, where are our flags? You know, and so somebody's groin squeezes down, for example, or they've reported they haven't slept well, or they're complaining of a bit of back stiffness or whatever that might be. And I think this is the really key thing. You've got to do something with the monitoring. I think, you know, players and athletes get really sick of filling things in if they feel that nothing's ever been done with it. And so we always nominate specific people to speak to specific players around anything that's a flag. And I think the other important thing there is it has to be a specific person who's going to do that rather than 3-4 people coming up to them. I see you didn't sleep well last night, and then somebody else says it. Then they start to get really paranoid. And so I think the monitoring stuff is about a conversation where we understand, well, yeah, we know why he's like that. Let's just touch base with him and have a conversation. So I think for me, the monitoring stuff is a thing that enables us to connect meaningfully, to use that word again, connect meaningfully with our players to have a conversation that is related to the feedback that they're giving us.
Just, I'd love to go through those and get more detail. Is that all right?
Of course, absolutely, yeah.
So on the wellness, that everyone's collecting sleep, soreness, etc. But is there anything specifically that you do differently? Is there any specific technology that you've made seem work better? You've changed recently, or something slightly different? Or is there any I suppose differences in the protocol that you've altered over time to get better data, to get more reliable data?
Yeah,
and insights.
And I'm probably going to disappoint you with this answer.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
We haven't really got a lot. Do you know that in terms of, as long as we keep, I think a big thing is keep it really simple. I think that's one thing that I think over the last number of years we try to use lots of very fancy different systems on things, but actually something that's really simple at the point of use and gives us really clear information and cuts out as much noise as possible. And so yeah, in terms of the scores, the guys are just inputting on to a system on we use TSO, the sports office, and they're inputting on their scores, their sleep scores, their appetite, and they're just ranking those on a simple numeric rating scale. So very simple. The one thing I guess is that's kept centrally. We do have, as the guys come in, their monitoring station. So the stuff is there. It's easy for them to do their sit and reach, to do their groin squeezes, their knee to wall. It's all there. They walk in and it's about the flow of the day. And so they'll the sense that they'll have done that, and we'll also look at body weight and so on. So the scales are there for these guys as well. So we're at least tracking that over time. I think the key thing that's helped is actually having, you know, one person, a sports scientist, who will be there to be able to pull that together, represent it in one screenshot and sense it, and then we'll have different colors. You know, the people will be green or be orange or red, essentially depending on how or their standard deviations, how much they've moved. And so very quickly we can just scan through and say, you know, where are the flags and what do we need to pay attention to. What we have as well then will be a separate system that looks at where they're also. So you know, you have that, if you've got that information, but you've got to be able to very quickly apply some context to it. And so we have then, it's actually done through Tableau, but you know, where we collate all of our other data sources together, and our data scientist Andy Whale really has put a really nice dashboard in place there around what are some of the other metrics. So some of our strength exposures, some of our speed exposures, are all of the usual running metrics that you would expect on GPS, so that you can go, well, oh, he's probably flagging here because this is what this looks like, or it's been, you know, 16 days and he hasn't had a sprint exposure. We need to do something about that potentially. So I guess that's the thing that's made the difference for us, rather than the particular measures. It's been how we've been able to visualize it and synthesize it and make it really easy for us to identify who we need to have the conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And that's it. The next one's sit and reach. Nothing sexy there, just what people would know.
It's not. And you know, I've hemmed and hawed for a while on this one, Rob, to be honest with you. Like, we used to have like shoulder rotational range and hip rotation range. I don't find in our population, not particularly helpful. Doesn't tell us anything. I think sit and reach is just that general thing that if it's way down, you're having a chat with someone, it's usually a flag for a bit of back pain or just that they're stiff and sore. So I think the big thing with any of the monitoring is, to me, don't overinterpret or give too much attention to a single measure. You know, and you know, if people's knee to wall is down, I'm usually going, that's usually something to do with an ankle joint. Do you know? And if because you know, if it's a calf, then we'll know about it. Do you know? We'll have the conversation. So, actually, again, knee to wall, I think for 90% of the guys doing it, it's probably not that important. But there's probably 10% for whom it's really can be quite important. Similar with the sit and reach, and I think those two sort of range of motion type exercises or tests have less benefit generally, but there's a small subgroup that we have there for whom they are important, which is why we keep them in.
Gosh. And the groin squeeze, I suppose that's the more options for testing availability there. What does that look like specifically for you guys?
Yeah, so we again keep it simple. It is done. We just use it's old fashioned one with the old Sphyg, you know, the blood pressure cuff sphygmomanometer, and we just get the guys to inflate that. They're sitting with their knees bent, doing straight leg and bent knee as well. So feet on the floor, knees bent to 90, between the knees, squeeze, record the number that's there, and then on straight legs and squeeze and record that number. And again, if we're seeing those numbers dropping down, there's usually a flag. I think it's an early warning sign that potentially we're starting to do a little bit of overload here, you know. And then, you know, we get into there's lots of other test, background testing stuff or other things that we may do with people, for example, if we're returning after injury, we will maybe stick extra monitoring tests in through there that they're usually done along with practitioners. But these are the ones that we do blanket wise for people.
I know you mentioned about the sit and reach and knee to wall, whether you are urinarium, whether they stay in. Is there anything that has been removed from that battery? Is there anything that has been recently added?
Yeah,
anything changes?
The stuff that we've taken out were the just the range of motion for shoulder and hip rotation. It's not sensitive enough to tell us anything, you know. And you know, there's stuff that we used to do, like I think way back, that we used to do, not necessarily within Irish rugby, things like a Thomas test, you know, hip flexor length. We tried everything, you know, over the years. I think that standing trunk flexion, you know, just, you know, there, bent knee fallout, we tried that as well, measuring the distance of the fibular head from the floor. All of those things, actually, we and this is, I guess that's the point, isn't it? We captured lots and lots of information and actually found that it wasn't that helpful. But I mean, that's helpful in and of itself that we no longer do that. So we've kept those in, and fully aware that for a lot of people, the knee to wall and the sit and reach will never change and never flag anything for some guys throughout their entire career. But for others, it will.
So that's the four that you've chosen for Irish rugby and obviously rugby players. Different sports may see different things that they may want to pay attention to. And I thought that is the key. How can, you know, rather than just going through experience and trying things and understanding, is there a process that you can go through to try to accelerate that a little bit to understand better what to pay attention to?
Yeah. Well, I guess then, the stuff that we would pull into our daily monitoring and the stuff that we look at weekly, as well, in terms of tracking stuff. So other weekly things that we would look at would, you know, or you know, so you look at some of our jump measures, be that a CMJ or drop jump measures we may have in there. Other things that we'll have in over time that, well, may not happen weekly, but certainly once every 3 to 4 weeks, we'll look at certainly Nord board scores, eccentric, and we'll look at some isometric seated calf scores as well. So they sort of fall somewhere in between the testing and monitoring piece, you know, so because they're more too, if you like, too frequent to be purely just testing, if you like, but not frequent enough to be monitoring. So in that classical sense, so I would still say, however, I would put them in a monitoring bucket, however, the our jump scores, and particularly, you know, if I'm working with very, you know, I think in the past working with sprinters and power based athletes, or if I'm working with swimmers, I'm probably going to pay a little bit more attention to some of those shoulder measures with our swimmers. I'm going to look at cuff strength and any inhibition that we might see there, and they're perhaps looking at some of their rate of force development stuff through their shoulder. If I'm prescribing particular types of training through a week. I'm probably going to look at things like their reactive strength index or some of their CMJ measures just to make sure that they're not overcooked from perhaps a neural fatigue side of things. So putting that in and certainly start of the week and at some stage towards the tail end of the week, just to see how guys' training is going and how they're adapting and their fatigue response.
The isometric seated calf. Mm. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we've been playing around with this for a little while now, and this is one of the examples of where as a system-wide approach, but then using some of the provincial expertise at a local level. So the guys at Munster, we've been working with them. So David Breen, Damien Morden, there. We've had various rigs we've set up. Initially, we started off setting, you know, with a force plate under a bar, you know, and pressing up against the bar. Perhaps wasn't as repeatable as we wanted, so we've created various different guys welding things and creating various setup. But essentially, what we're trying to do is view it a bit like the groin squeeze for calves, if you like. So, and we've agreed what we want to see is sort of a 1.8 to 2 times body weight on a seated isometric calf that they, in terms of their force that they can produce. So we've played around where we get guys sitting, strap them in, put a strap over the top of the knee, a little bit of a padding, strap them right in with it in a slight bit of dorsiflexion. So we're looking in that range. And then they just do a maximum isometric calf. So they just push that knee up through the strap as hard as they can. And a couple of tests on that each leg. And so we've refined our processes where we can have that done and through in less than 5 minutes, which is great. It's tough whenever you're trying to do that for everybody all of the time. So, you know, it is one of those, however, I think that falls in that bucket of if we're doing a lot with guys and there's maybe a flag with a history of calf injury, there's a history of ankle stuff, we want to just make sure that they're tracking in the right direction. Particularly then we will test everyone on their strength. And for those guys who we think are not strong enough, okay, so we know we have guys who are less than 1 times body weight. Force, so they're significantly down yet functioning very well. Those are the guys then we'll monitor over time to make sure they're tracking in the right direction to improve.
Gosh, and you found that sensitive enough to tell you what you want? I know you said there's been some refinement along the way.
Yeah, I think it has. And I think what we're certainly seeing is where if you see a significant drop in some of those calf forces, then that is to me a bit like your flag for your groin. It's a flag that we're reaching that stage of a little bit, we're overcooking these guys. And calf injuries, as I'm sure you're aware, have really increased over the last few seasons, and certainly within rugby, and we see it within football, we see it in other sports as well. We're seeing our hammies, we've got sort of under control. They're dropping down a little bit, or they've stabilized. Calves have gone up for sure, and then I think that this is one thing that calves are very different, hamstrings and how they operate and how they need to be managed, obviously, in terms of their function. So I think that's where it's been particularly helpful to try and get a sense of how are these calves responding to load. And for those calves that we start to see a bit of, you know, cumulative fatigue, particularly soleus, which is the big powerhouse of the lower limb, where we see a lot of soleus fatigue kicking in and a reduced ability to generate force, then we're starting to see some of these low-grade soleus injuries. And, you know, there's great work by Brady Green out in La Trobe, and his PhD looked at an AFL, but how soleus injuries are those ones, they tend not to have the acute sharp sensation, but that it's the gradual onset, often after a session or even the day after. You've got this low grade soreness in a calf that isn't resolving, and then you scan them and find out, oh, hang on, we've got a soleus strain here. And so that's probably raised our antenna a lot more for having early warning signals, and, you know, is our force production capabilities down, or is there greater stiffness and soreness there? Then we've got a high index of suspicion that there's something going on in that soleus.
Why do you think there's such an uptick in calf injuries in rugby and football?
Yeah, we've had lots of conversations in this space in the last in the last year or two. I think my gut on this, and this is entirely just my gut, I hasten to add, okay, so I'm certainly open for discussion on it, is, you know, we've shifted a lot of our running, and we've perhaps reduced our overall running volume somewhat, and we focused, appropriately so for hamstrings, on a lot of our very high speed running, our sprint distance, and maybe some of our HMLD type running. What we know though is a calf works hard all the time. Actually, a calf reaches its peak force at around 5 meters per second almost. Yeah, so that sort of speed of just high speed running, a calf is working really hard when our hamstrings aren't working hard at all. And then as we get faster, actually the calf forces drop a little bit when we start to sprint and our hamstrings go up through the roof. And so that longer running that we maybe would have done historically, the volume running, provided just an endurance and a capacity to the calf that perhaps had a protective effect in many respects. And, you know, I think with controlling our volumes somewhat, then potentially then we haven't built that. And I would talk about power endurance really being a key component in my sense with our calf. And so the other thing is there aren't many programs where we're doing specific calf strengthening work. You know, we assume, you know, the calf works all the time, therefore it's getting lots of load. Also, when you do calf strengthening work, guys get a bit stiff and sore. And so when do you fit it in initially in across your season? And so there's perhaps been a reticence to do calf strengthening the same way as there has been in a lot of the other lowland. We think by proxy, just by running, it gets stronger. I think it doesn't necessarily. We need overload like any other muscle. So with the absence of specific calf strengthening and perhaps a reduction in overall running loads, we have calves that are perhaps less able to cope with the bandwidth and what's being thrown at them. Would be my gut on it.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Cool. Right. Next 10, 15 minutes, last point that we had. And this point was after I'd reviewed a couple of podcasts from quite a while ago, and I'd reviewed Grant Downey's. And one thing that he brought up was this risk aversion, especially in the youth population that he used to work with at various different football clubs. And I'd love to get your take on whether, I know that sun's coming across your face a little.
Sliding across to here out of it. I thought I had it out of the way there.
No problem. It's absolutely fine. So yeah, just to get your take on whether we are becoming more risk averse from a performance staff versus maybe 10 years ago, for example.
Yeah, do you know, whenever you suggested talking about this, and you know, and I know the Grant's podcast, we talked about that as well. I would very much be on that same page, and I think we've got so good at measuring everything, and it's been very subtle and imperceptible, and with very good motives, I hasten to add. Really good motives around saying we want to keep these guys healthy. We want to avoid injury. We therefore measure everything, and we're going to pay attention to the load that we're putting these guys in so that they don't break, because these are valuable resources potentially. And our job as practitioners is to keep these guys fit and healthy. And hey, that's all right to a point, because actually we recognize that the real reason we all have a job is for performance. It's to help people perform at their very best and to see what we're capable of and to try to say, how good can you really be? And our job is about building resilient, robust, high-performing athletes who can maximally perform and train consistently over time, over and over again. And so the minute we shift away from a performance first mindset to a protective mindset, I think that comes in and subtly changes all of the decisions that we make around, you know, a training availability. How much more will I push? Will I do that extra rep? You know, and we go for, you know, efficiency is great in one way, but efficiency is also in many ways the enemy of innovation. You know, because it's about stripping away all the unnecessary, but we don't even know what the unnecessary is there. I think once we start to skip the hard things, then we're in trouble.
One anecdote that that Grant mentioned in his podcast was, I think it was under 13, under 14s having a recovery day. And he was not happy that was termed a recovery day. He said the recovery day for under 14 should be going out and, you know, ball work and this and that. And the fact that we're enforcing this recovery day makes them psychologically think that we can only handle one game a week, when you get to the Man City's level and they're playing Saturday, Tuesday, Friday, you know, three days a week sometimes. Is that something that you would also, I suppose, echo Grant's sentiments on?
Yeah, I think it's a really nice way to put it. I think, you know, no one is suggesting, I think, and I don't think you're suggesting, that you're working maximally full on every day of the week.
Of course.
So, okay, if we can assume that as a starting point, I think then we can say, how can we help these guys and girls to develop over time in the best possible way psychologically, and so that they view themselves as, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, when I was a teenager, I thought I was bulletproof. And so, and that's good. That's a normal thing. You know, so our job is about, sometimes it can be about holding back and about tuning in. But if we're doing stuff that is shifting, where people are feeling that I can't do too much because I might break, hey man, that's dangerous ground, isn't it? For anybody to be in. And our goal, and obviously coming at it, historically, I, you know, having worked a lot with a lot of people with, you know, chronic injuries and recurrent injuries and complex injuries over time. And so I would often say with that population, and I'll bring this back to the 14-year-old in a moment, but with that population, the goal here was to restore confidence in being able to use your spine, your hamstring, your knee normally again. That's your number one goal. Once you can get to that space, then it opens up new possibilities. Yeah. The minute I put limits on my body and start viewing myself as fragile, you know, it comes back to that anti-fragility perspective that you know, that I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote the anti-fragility stuff.
Yes,
but slightly different to resilience, and in that it's anti-fragile. Once I throw a lot of stuff at it, I can bounce back and I get better. And so that's where I think what we sow into the younger athletes, into the kids, we're going to reap as when they're adults, for sure. And I think there's a super window there to be wise about how we use our time, for sure. But the idea of saying to them, here's a day where you got to rest and regenerate, I hesitate to say this, Rob, because it makes me sound like a probably the old grumpy man, maybe. But there is the sense kids many years ago were out playing and doing stuff every day, all the time. Yeah. And we're all good, you know? And so I think the idea that kids can get out and just kick a ball around and enjoy it and have joy, and where perhaps that regeneration day or recovery day is a day where they just have the sheer joy of playing some sport and kicking a ball around and enjoy it, but without perhaps the same level of intensity or the same level of contact if they're playing a contact sport, you know, but it's a day where they have good consolidation and joy. Because what we know even about learning and motor learning, when you enjoy it, you learn much better. We know that. There's really good science around cognitive science in that. And when it matters, you will learn and get better more often. And something will matter to you when you enjoy it. Surprise, surprise. So if we put in the stress on guys saying, you can't do this in case you break. You've got to have a day off. This is so important. And we're putting pressure on these young kids as they're developing over time. I think we need to really consider how we do that. Add back enjoyment. Add a nice rhythm and cadence to the week where there's days where it isn't as high intensity. But the idea that you got to stop. Yeah, I get worried about that. And what we see, I'm going on a slight soapbox here, everyone. But then we see that carry over in this over medicalization of training often. And so the number of guys that over the last number of years that we've identified potentially who, for very good reason at a time, have said, well, you're not allowed to squat anymore. You know, you can't back squat because you've got back pain, or you can't do this, so we'll modify you. You're only doing, you know, a trap bar deadlift or whatever that might be, or maybe not even, or you're doing a step up. Then what happens is they get chronically underloaded. And actually what that spine requires is good axial load. The very thing we think is going to protect them is the thing that's making them less robust. And so not being overly medical about how we put stuff together, but say, how can we make sure they can do as much as possible and as safely as possible and enjoy it as much as possible? So, sorry, I could have gone off in a few routes there. So
No, it's fine. I know, like you said at the start, this is all with good intentions, But what do you think that for the over-medicalization of the things you've just spoken about, is that, does that link back to what you said at the start with the, you know, looking after these high profile players and, you know, commodities, the big values, etc., that we're just protecting ourselves as well as hopefully the athlete, and it's kind of just all of a sudden just get steps down until you remove an exercise and things like that?
Yeah, and that's, Joe, I can think of a number of athletes who are players who are really talented, and the goal has always been make sure they play at the weekend. Yeah, big game at the weekend. So let's not overcook them during the week. Let's hold them back over the week so that we can roll them out at the weekend to play, because they maybe have a bit of low-grade soreness or stiffness or a little bit of a very low-grade tight hammy or lumbar spine. So we go, oh, I don't want to flare that up, so I'm going to hold back in order to get them on the pitch at the weekend. And then that happens again. And then it happens again. And all of a sudden, you're a year down the line and you've got this person who is really fragile, who gets rolled out of against, and your fingers are crossed that they're going to make it through a full game. And I think that's where it ends up. And so I can think of a few players that we've actually started from there to go, how can we get them back and actually be brave enough to say, you've got to lift in the gym today, because that's the thing that's going to help you compete at weekends consistently. But that's often the first thing that gets pulled out whenever, you know, as a mindset, because we get into this protective mindset. Perhaps it's about ourselves as well, and there's huge pressure coming from coaches and players and owners and so on to get people out on the pitch at the weekend. But I think what I've seen is consistently the guys who you can get consistent exposure and we're disciplined enough to do that are almost not irrespective of what they're telling us about, you know, you do listen to the athlete, but not to be so fearful of pushing people to get the best, to be the best they can be, that we end up actually making them worse in the longer run. So I see that a lot. And then I actually think there are many, many players whose careers then get shortened as a consequence of that.
Yeah. I think I'm going to save you, Phil, from that sun that's going to come across into your right eye in a second. But just before that does happen and blind that right eye, where can people get to know more about you? Where can people follow you, follow your work, social media, website, etc.?
Yeah, website's just philglasgow.com. It's easy to connect with me there, and there's a little bit about me, and also LinkedIn and Twitter, it's at Phil Glasgow. And if anyone wants to unpack some of these conversations or reach out or are interested in following up on anything we've discussed, be really delighted to do that.
And the coaching stuff's on there as well, isn't it?
Yeah, there's coaching stuff. Again, people are interested in looking at some of the coaching stuff or exploring that further, more than happy. Yeah.
Brilliant. Phil, thank you very much for open and honest conversation. Absolutely love it. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, Rob. Enjoyed that.
Cheers, Phil.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 404 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. So it was an absolute delight to interview Phil, have a little chat around the centralised system and some player monitoring and daily screening stuff as well. Big thanks to Phil for giving up his time, but also huge thanks to Hawking Dynamics, Kitman Labs, Black Box Fitness, Samson and Play for sponsoring this episode today. The podcast could not run in its current form without these guys, so I really do appreciate all their support. Big thanks to you for tuning in, and look forward to speaking to you next week.